Well, I think this is great that the Center for Mathematical Medicine is up and running officially as of now. I think it's got a lot exciting potential, and I am excited to be involved in any way I can. So, a couple of you in the audience may have seen some of these slides before, and I'm sorry for that, but you know, there's only so much to go around. So, what I'll tell you about today is a little bit of mathematical medicine that I do, which is clinical applications of quantitative models for invasive brain tumors. The type of brain tumors that I'm specifically referring to are gliomas, which are quite invasive, and I'll explain that in a lot more detail throughout this. So, gliomas are invasive brain tumors with no effective treatments. They're essentially uniformly fatal lesions, and no matter what, no matter what, 99% of the time, patients will die as a result of their disease, unless some other acute occurrence happens. Typically, there's quite a wide range of gliomas, ranging from everything from a low-grade glioma, the lowest possible grade gliomas, which range in median survival times of about 10 years, where high-grade gliomas do their thing about 10 times as fast. So something like a year to 10 months to 16 months would be a typical median survival for high-grade gliomas treated. The highest-grade gliomas are often referred to as glioblastomas. It's a terminology. So throughout this talk, I'll refer to glioblastoma quite a lot. And I'll try and give you a sprinkling of information from everything from the low grades, the ones that do their thing in about 10 years, to those high grades that do their thing in the matter of about 10 months. Glioma cells are highly motile. The cells themselves get up and literally walk around within the brain, and this results in a very diffuse tumor growth, and it's unlike many other sort of incantations of tumors that you might have. A tumor you think of as a bulky lesion without much going on in the neighboring areas. You can often think of some tumors are encapsulated. These are nothing like that. These really do invade into the local tissue quite efficiently. The cells are also known to migrate more quickly in the differing tissue in the brain, the gray and white matter, and I'll show you lots more pictures about this. The point was to develop and integrate imaging characteristics with pathological studies to predict tumor progression. So was there a way we could take what the patients looked like in the clinic on their MRIs, combine that with what we know about the histology to tell us whether it's low grade, high grade, or some variation in between, and make predictions of tumor progression using mathematical modeling? And we also wanted to see if we could use such a tool to evaluate current and future treatments, how well surgical resection works, how well radiation therapy works, and how well chemotherapies work. So I love this picture because this is a snapshot out of a medical text describing what a primary brain tumor might look like in a brain slice. So first of all, let's go through a little anatomy here just for those that may not know anything about the brain. The gray matter is the stuff that's sort of brown in this picture. The white matter is the bits in the middle. The gray matter is where the neuron cell bodies lie, and the white matter is where the long axon tails extend. So every bit of gray matter is connected to every other bit of gray matter by a long network of white matter fibers. So information is propagated along these white matter fibers, but it also turns out that glioma cells tend to like walking, like wandering in these white matter regions also. So I like this picture because this looks like a nice solitary image of a brain tumor. You expect this to be a picture of any sort of tumor, a leg tumor, liver tumor. You think of a tumor as just a nodule, but the reality is much different. Again, sort of squint your eyes and realize that this is the real life version of this slice here, and that although this primary brain tumor could have started, this primary brain tumor in the bottom left panel could have started at approximately the same location as the one in the example, the reality is much different. The cells have invaded significantly in the white matter regions and all the way up to the cortex at the top. And so here's just to make it absolutely clear, this granular looking tissue that's kind of shiny and creamy is the malignancy. Now, what is well known in glioma studies is that if you were to biopsy tissue here, and biopsy tissue here, you would find glioma cells. So even though you focus your eye on this nasty-looking bits in the middle, this portion of the lesion, which I actually outlined for you, the reality is that there are malignant cells throughout the brain. They really have invaded long distances throughout the central nervous system. What's slightly odd about these tumors is they really don't metastasize outside of the CNS. There are a couple of theories on that, but there's some evidence to say that that's simply because they kill the patient too quickly, and that there's not time for a secondary metastasis to occur. But there's many other theories on this. So let's imagine we are God, and we are going to walk along this path, and we can actually estimate how many, we can actually measure, not estimate, but actually measure how many glioma cells we're going to encounter as we walk along this path. And I would imagine that there would be very few cells out here, more and more as you get towards the tumor, less on the other, many within the tumor, and then less on the other side. When I say the tumor, I mean the bulky portion of the tumor, realizing, of course, that there are malignant cells out here. So with that in mind, let's go to this picture, which shows you what it would be like to walk along that path. So we're walking from the left side of the brain to the right side of the brain. This gray curve is a measure of glioma cell density. There's low cell density, low numbers of malignant cells out here, quite high towards the center of the tumor. At the very center of the tumor, there could be necrosis associated with there not being enough vasculature to grow the tumor there. So there would be a valley there. And then on the other side, you walk off the other side, and there's a similar distribution. And when you biopsy these locations within that tumor a couple pages earlier, you in fact find that towards the center there's necrosis. So in these, for those of you not used to looking at histological slides, basically you want to look for the blue. The blue are the nucleus, the nuclei in these cases, and this is hematoxylin and eosin stain. The blue, there's not much blue here, so there's not many living cells there. There's quite a few living cells just here. There's less here and even less further out here, and this is almost looking like a nearly normal tissue. So what we propose is that this distribution would be contributed to by the most dominant things that we know about gliomas. And the most dominant things we know about gliomas is that they invade extensively in the brain and they proliferate extensively, obviously. Otherwise, they wouldn't look like this in the hyperdense portions of the tumor. So with those simple things in mind, we can write down a mathematical model, a basic mathematical model of glioma growth and invasion. This is probably the simplest thing you could conjure up with those assumptions and those bits of ideas so far. Basically, that any given location within the tumor, the rate of change of the tumor cell density is going to be given by dispersal of the tumor cells plus net proliferation of those tumor cells. Dispersal or migration of those cells is going to be modulated by the parameter D. So D is a function of the spatial variable X that differentiates gray and white matter, because we know that the cells migrate more quickly in the white matter than they do in the gray. So we want to keep track of that. And rho is just a measure of net proliferation. It's related to the doubling time of these cells. So C throughout here has been referring to tumor cell density, and D and rho are things I'm going to refer to over and over again through this. So let's skip past this. So let's return to this idea, and I realize that net proliferation is much more complex than just something called rho, and that you could imagine you've developed some new drug that's targeting any one of these or the millions more molecular genetic pathways that may be of interest to net, that eventually trickle down to net proliferation, and we can model those aspects of that. Similarly, we can do the same thing for invasion. So studies of proliferative mechanisms or pathways that cause excess proliferation in cancers in general, but specifically gliomas, as well as mechanisms of invasion, are under study in many situations to determine new treatment approaches. So any of these approaches could be integrated into a model like this. We're just treating this model as sort of a macroscopic model, and think of it as a clinical level model. So what you see in the clinic is the macroscopic tumor. So to reiterate that point a little bit more, let's look at what you do see in the clinic. The top image on the left would be a standard T1-weighted gadolinium-enhanced MRI, so T1-GAD MRI. And the image on the right is the T2-weighted MRI. These are two types of MRIs used for high-grade glioma patients, glioblastomas. These are the typical modes of surveillance for these patients. This is a typical for modes for initial suspicion of tumor, then biopsy to validate the fact that, yes, we've determined that histologically it is a glioblastoma, and this is how patients are followed. And you can think of these, or at least I do, is we bring this picture back here, and this is sort of a distribution of the glioma cell density that I've shown you in the last couple slides. The image on the left you can think of as one level of the water. associated with an iceberg. So I sort of think of it as a threshold of detection or level of the water. If you imagine you can only see the portion of the iceberg that's above the level of the water, this green line represents sort of the edge of detectability on this T1 weighted gadolinium MRI. And this is an assumption that I've used so far. Basically, what I refer to is a T1 GAD MRI is thought to be associated with the solid portion of the tumor, the thing that when on autopsy you look at it, it looks like a big nasty thing. And when you biopsy it, there's lots of cells there. And there's lots of vasculature there, which is the reason why it becomes bright on gadolinium-enhanced MRI. The T2 MRI is associated with another threshold of detection, another level of the water associated with the iceberg. And it, when you sample in the regions out here of the T2-weighted regions, you'll find isolated tumor cells or anedema of swelling of the brain. So the question I had was, if this is the standard clinical approach and you're using both of these things to direct therapy, but primarily the one on the left directs therapy, can we use this information in any smart way with the idea of the iceberg shape in the background to make any predictions about what's going to happen to these tumors? So we looked at that mathematical model one more time, and we just did some simulations. And we estimated the T1 GAD with a threshold of detection of about 8 times 10 to the 6 cells per cubic centimeter, which is this thick black contour. These simulations are in fully 3 dimensions, but I'm only showing you 3 standard planes. I'm going to try and orient you to the movie I'm going to show you in just a second. Top image is a sagittal plane. The coronal image is the second one, which is a face-on view, and then the bottom one is an axial or horizontal view sliced through the brain. These simulations were initiated with at the asterisk, which is in where if you put these three planes together, they would all intersect at that single starred location. And the color contours are contours of cell density, blue being a low cell density and red being a high cell density. So way out at the edges, we're not finding so many tumor cells, but as you get towards the center of the tumor, there's quite a few tumor cells. And the thick black contour, again, is the edge associated with the T1 weighted gadolinium MRI. So with that orientation, this would be a typical size at diagnosis, about 3 centimeters in diameter, and this would be sort of a typical size at death. It's about 6 centimeters in diameter. So with that orientation, let's look at a movie of this. This is a similar lesion. It's not the same one I simulated in the previous slide. Don't start with the blinking. I've been having problems with my video driver in this new laptop, and it's very irritating. So the starred location is as it was before. These are blue contours represent low cell density, not zero cell density. So if you sample in this region, you would be able to find some measurable portion of number of cells. And the thick black contour is exactly what I've showed you before, which is the T1 weighted gadolinium MRI. The thing to note from this is that I showed you a 128-day time scale. That's pretty fast for a high-grade glioma. It's really about 10 times as long as that from incarnation at this little thick black, at the black asterisk, to a fatal size. Maybe 1,280 days would be a more reasonable estimate. What you should note from this, though, is for the 128-day time scale that we've shown here, for the first 100 days, there was nothing visible on the T1-weighted gadolinium MRI. So by the time the patients are showing up in the clinic, there was a significant amount of invasion that's already happened. This is just showing you not even the zero cell density curve. So there's more cells over here. So the focus of treatment on everything within the thick black contour is quite limiting to what the reality of the tumor is. Again, it's having to do with this iceberg phenomenon. You can see the tip of the iceberg. The problem is what's below the level of the water that's going to be the problem. So going back to the pictures of the thresholds of detection and thinking about the mathematical model, it turns out that this distribution, which is a solution of that mathematical model, has a solution that gives you a traveling wave. So basically, over time, the rate at which the edge of this tumor, the detectable portion of this edge of the tumor, either on T1 GAD or T2 MRI, moves out at a rate proportional to the product of to the square root of the product of the rate of proliferation and the rate of migration of cells. So this is a solution of that Fisher type equation that was the mathematical equation earlier. And basically, this velocity of growth of the tumor, is contributed to by both migration of cells and proliferation of cells, and that's sort of important. Traditionally, you look at a graph in experimental literature, you'll look at a graph of growth of the tumor over time, and you'll plot it and you'll determine, say, assume it's exponentially growing, you fit it to an exponential curve, and you associate that with a doubling time, a proliferation rate for these cells. When the reality is that the rate at which the edge of the tumor is spreading is related to both migration and proliferation. So both of these things need to be taken into account. But we've already assumed that, so here's our curve, and one of the initial simple solutions of that mathematical model gives us a constant velocity traveling wave. So that means that plotting the radius versus time of the tumor should be a straight line. And another way to look at that is that although the total number of glioma cells in the brain are growing something like exponentially in the blue curve, the T1 GAD MRI, or the T2 MRI, the portion of the tumor that's detectable by this means, is only going to grow linearly. So there's a dichotomy between what's visible in the clinic and what the reality would be if you could magically integrate over the whole brain. So one of the first tests we did was just looked at some GFP, so it's a green fluorescent protein labeled rat glioma, glioblastoma cell line. And here are some examples of these rats. This is not absolutely important. It's just sort of proof that there was an experiment done. This is right here is the tumor. The thing that's kind of nice about this picture is that you can see that there's a tumor, what appears to be an edge of the tumor, but yet there's invaded cells out here and out here and out here. If you look closely, this is necrosis of the tumor, and here's a different view with the more, you can see the hypercellular tumor there. This is, again, central necrosis and then tumor around here. The point to this picture is, or the reason I like to plot this, is that when this experiment was done in a lab at the University of Washington, they plotted the area of the tumor over time. So they would take a slice, do these experiments, inject this into rats, let the rat live for another 12, 15 days, sacrifice the rat, and then look at the areas. They would actually did it for 3 days, seven days or 9 days, and then 11 days. So they did these serial sacrifices of these rats and calculated the area that they saw in this slice through the tumor to estimate that. And that's what they reported in the literature, was the plot of the area versus time. When you plot the area versus time, it just looks like it's kind of growing. It actually looks like a parabola. It looks like a t-squared sort of thing. But if you just take the square root of their area to get a measure of mean radius, you see that it fits a straight line, almost sort of ridiculously exactly, with an R-square of 0.9999, which is absurd, that it would do so well and come so close to a straight line. So granted, these are only 3 data points, but please note that each of these data points is associated with about 10 animals. So the point is that our initial simplest possible experimental model you could apply to are the tumors growing with a constant velocity reasonable? Sure, for this experiment. There's many problems with that. So let's go back to the clinical case. One of the problems with trying to track tumor growth over time is that patients don't tend to not want their tumors treated. But there's a small exception related to low-grade gliomas. Low-grade gliomas can be followed for significant periods of time. And this comes from data from, specifically in France, where this data comes from. So this is an initial set of 27 patients followed without intervening treatments, but we have an additional 350 of these patients that have been followed with similar pictures. So if you plot just the diameter of versus time of their T2 MRI size, and the T2 MRI size in this case was measured by just 3 perpendicular diameters and then averaged those 3 perpendicular diameters, you see that the data is kind of messy, but the measurement's kind of messy, as 3 perpendicular diameters is not the cleanest way to measure these things. But if you plot these things versus time, you see that there's quite a heterogeneity at the way, at the size at diagnosis. But they all tend to be progressing along modestly a straight line, and in a very similar rate. So to test that, to take into account the various sizes at the time of diagnosis, the lead time bias associated with that, you can use a linear mixed effects statistical model with a random intercept to sort of normalize out that effect, and then the time variable becomes realigned, and then you can realign these they all end up clumping together in this very nice way. So what this says is that not only do individually these patients progress along a fairly linear path, but as a group they progress along a common linear path. There are certainly deviations from it, because that red curve is different than this blue curve, but it's within, for this common histological grade, this is a big deal. This may not seem like much from the mathematicians in the audience, because it's fitting straight lines to data. But what is interesting from this is that if you threw a group of neuro-oncologists into a room and you asked them, you've got a patient with a glioma today, what do you expect that patient with a glioma to turn out like tomorrow or next week or next month? The answers you're going to get are everything from absolutely random. There's no way to interpret. It may grow exponentially, but you can't possibly know the exponential rate it's growing, to it could regress and decide it doesn't want to do anything anymore. It could just be stable. You would get every answer but that it's going to continually progress at a constant rate, or nearly constant rate. So, as I said, these low-grade gliomas, you can find a decent number of these low-grade gliomas, but you can't find so many high-grade gliomas that go untreated, because these are aggressive, they fatal within a year or so. So patients come into the clinic and are immediately have surgical resection and then move on to radiation therapy and chemotherapy. So I've replotted those same patients from that previous slide. There's my 27 low grades at about an average of about 2 millimeters per year in MR detectable radius versus time. And then the high grades do their thing in about 10 times as fast, which is linked directly to their survival times. They're about a tenfold variation between those two things. So you can look at sort of the distributions of the velocities of these rates of growth. Here's my sad little four high-grade gliomas, which I actually have more of these now, but they're not been included in this figure. And then 28 low-grades in this case, which now is 350 or so. So what we're kind of interested in is how these things might link to histology. How discrete is it that this histological group of patients manifests this exact velocity? Is there another histological group that lands here, or is it just a sort of a uniform distribution? What do we expect? We don't know. So this is something we're working on, related to looking actually at some proteomic analysis also, and comparing that to rates of growth. So going back to our threshold of detection, so far all I've done is say, okay, well, we can track the growth of a tumor and fit a straight line to it, and that's not that exciting. And that's that part. But the question was, could we do better? Could we do more, obtain more information from the fact that we've got two levels of threshold of detection? And if you look at this curve again one more time, and you look at solutions to this curve, which is the mathematical equivalent of those equations, look at the solutions to the mathematical model, which are the gray curve, you can actually deduce a nonlinear relationship between the size on T1 weighted gadolinium MRI and the size on T2 weighted MRI. And that gives you a relationship between the ratio of the migration rate to the proliferation rate of cells. And this sort of logically makes sense, that D over rho is going to tell you basically how steep this contour is. It's not a slope. I've drawn it as a slope for simplicity, but if you have a very quickly proliferating tumor and a very slowly diffusing tumor, it's going to have a very steep profile, whereas if the tumor is quickly diffusing, relatively speaking, it's going to have a very shallow profile. So one would expect that you would be able to extract some sort of information like that from the T1, the relative sizes of the T1 GAD and the T2 MRI. So if you can do that, what can you do with that? Well, let's go back to a case of a high-grade glioma that was actually followed and untreated. This is a case of a 75-year-old female who presented with a complex partial seizure. She refused advice to receive biopsy for diagnosis and treatment, but she accepted multiple MRIs, which is fairly unusual. So this is the image on the left. This is like equivalent of a T2 type MRI. This is a flare, well known as a flare MRI, in September of 2000. And 9 months later, thank you, the tumor has grown significantly in size, and the patient lived, interestingly, this patient, even though she received no treatment, lived 1 week short of her year predicted survival. So you can see that this type of tumor is nasty and aggressive, but the question is, can we take just those first two imaging time points? We have four imaging time points. Let's just take those first two points. Let's take the flare, which is the equivalent of the T2, and the T1 GAD, combine those together and get an estimate of D over rho. And let's combine the T1 GAD at the two time points together to get a velocity and estimate d times rho. And what can we do? Well, the d times rho is manifest in this velocity term of 14 millimeters per year. And from these the measurements I just made of d over rho here and d times rho here, you can estimate d and rho independently. Okay, well, I'll explain what you can do to that. So far, this is just academic. I've, again, just estimated some numbers. The real question is does this predicted path match for this patient? And the patient had two further MRIs, and it fits very well to the predicted path of growth, one. So we can all fit a straight line to four data points, which is good. And it fits well, which is even better. One thing that's interesting here is to just take note with you as we walk through the next few slides is that the patient's performance score, her sort of her neurological status, with regard to her tumor, although she had a complex partial seizure at this initial time point, she really had no other manifestations that were problematic over time this direction until 2 months before death, and then she just had this precipitous decline. And we're interested to know if it's possible that this had nothing that what that this precipitous decline had to do with this diffuse invasion of critical structures in the brain that may not be visible on imaging, and we have a working theory on that. So here's a couple pictures across the top of this patient's diagnostic MRI. Here's her three views, and here's simulations associated with that. The thick black contour would be again the edge of the T1 GAD. Thick black contour edge of the T1 GAD, and the blue contours are all contours that we can't measure, but we can predict exist. We can't certainly measure in this case when the patient was still alive, but we can measure them at autopsy and do comparisons of that. So one of the things that my lab does is looks at autopsy specimens and compares them with simulations and does detailed mapping of these things and overlays. And the model predicted distribution, at least grossly, looks vaguely reasonable, but the real test is microscopically. How well does it do at sort of a millimeter-ish level? You can show that it turns out that you can look at this in much more detail if you were sort of just walk along this path here, and here's the nasty bulky portion of the tumor. When you're out in gray matter, there's not so many cells. When you get in white matter, there's quite a few more cells. In the tumor, there's quite a bit of bumpiness associated with this valley here has to do with the fact that we went from the one side of the brain to the other side. And then you can look at different maps of white and gray matter. We do a different approach now to this where we look at detailed square millimeter maps over the whole, two-dimensional maps over the whole brain slice. Feeling a little funny, like something has happened with my slides, but okay. So let's go on with that information. So we've so far just in this case estimated D and rho for that patient, and we can compare to simulations at autopsy. We can compare simulations at autopsy, and they all seem to be agreeing at least modestly well. But can we do anything else with the broader spectrum of patients that exist? So let's look at about 70 high-grade patients that were treated with radiation therapy followed after they had received either biopsy, a subtotal resection, or a gross total resection. So what we do have for information for these patients is just their diagnostic MRI. We don't have any other further information about these patients. We have their survival time and their diagnostic MRI. So we don't have the two imaging time points to be able to estimate both migration and proliferation rate for these things, for these patients. But we do have means to estimate D over rho. So if you take a plot of the T2 weighted MRI versus the T1 weighted MRI for each of these patients, you see that in the blue asterisks are the biopsy and subtotal resection patients grouped together, and the red squares are the gross total resection patients. The biopsy and subtotal resection patients are grouped together on purpose because they tend to have some very similar survival dynamics, and that way you get sort of balanced numbers in each of these groups. It's almost exactly split in half. The goal was just to use just the diagnostic MRI and predict some sort of potential for future behavior. What can we get from that? So here's a plot of just looking at the biopsy subtotal resection group. The percent survivors plotted versus survival time on this is plotted here. Now, if we use what we've been using so far, which is we can take the T1 GAD and the T2 radii and estimate rho over D, we can estimate the steepness of that slope. We know what a typical rho is for these glioblastoma patients, which would be about a 60-day doubling time. We can estimate a velocity for this velocity of growth. We can predict how quickly it's going to proceed out from its diagnostic size, the tumor is. And the death on average is at about 6 centimeters in diameter. There's huge heterogeneity in that in vivo, but on average this is about a number that keeps popping up in autopsy studies and it has historically. And you can see that when you use this to estimate the blue the blue model predicted survival curve, you can see that they match very well for these 30-ish number of patients, of biopsy subtotal resection patients. You can imagine patients that receive gross total resection or some sort of more invasive treatment would be slightly different. One would hope that gross total resection is doing something for these patients. So here's a plot, again, of the actual survival curve for these gross total resection patients. Let's do exactly what we did on the previous slide. Act as if gross total resection did nothing. So this would be the equivalent of what would the model predict if there was no effect, if biopsy with subtotal resection was essentially in no effect whatsoever. Then this leftmost curve would be what was generated. But instead of doing that, let's try and do another curve where we do a virtual resection at this step. Instead of just predicting a growth with uninhibited without removing any tissue, let's actually virtually remove tissue. And I'll show you a movie about how I did that in the next slide. So you virtually remove the tissue, and there's sort of two ways to think about gross total resection. Gross total resection is you go in and you lop out the bright spot on the T1 GAD MRI. Well, you could lop out exactly the amount of the T1 GAD MRI or a little bit more. Whatever it is in the end, it's going to be the T1 GAD is going to be what was there before is going to be gone. So there's a minimal T1 minimal resection, which is just removing just the radius visible on T1 GAD. So you magically go in and allow for no fancy approaches to the tumor or anything like that. You just simply remove everything within that cell density, and that gives you the circled curve. Now, if you were to remove another 25% of extra tumorous tissue, that would sort of be a maximal gross total resection or an extensive gross total resection. You get these diamond curves, and as you can see, the predicted curves fall exactly where you expect them, or the actual data falls exactly where you expect them, depending on your perspective. So the model does a good job at even taking just the diagnostic information and having some predictability in terms of what's going to happen in the future for these patients. I promised you some sort of visualization of what happens for these, how you can simulate resection. So this is similar to the pictures I've shown you before. The thick black contour is going to be what's visible on T1 weighted gadolinium MRI. And in this case, what I'm going to do is sort of think of the most optimistic tumor I can imagine, a little 1 centimeter in diameter tumor at the frontal pole right there. And we're going to lop off the whole frontal pole, and then we're going to watch the recurrence pattern. Now, this movie, again, was generated originally for a group of neurosurgeons where I didn't show them the blue contours. I only showed them the thick black contour, again, focusing on the track the T1 GAD. The T1 GAD is what's used clinically to direct much of treatment, so let's just track that. And during this time where there was no T1 GAD, clearly, we would have this chat about how I had virtually cured this patient and wasn't this great, and they were getting agitated and getting ready to leap from their seats. About the time that I sufficiently agitated them, the thick black curve decides to show up, and you get this lovely typical clinical recurrence, typical in the clinic recurrence of the tumor. In what appears to be a very aggressive way, it feels like this is growing much faster than it was initially, doesn't it? But the reality is it's just simply a size association thing, because the cell dynamics have not changed. I've not changed the parameters D and rho. I just simply didn't show you the whole view. So then I would re-show the movie to the neurosurgeons again, this time with the full view, with the model curves, and then they would still be very agitated about it. So I haven't quite figured out how to get rid of the agitation, but the point is that the clinical appearance of what appears to be a completely separate nodule some extended period of time later, this is 1,200 days out, is a common thing that's actually published in many cases, that the patients had an extensive resection and they were very unlucky to have another tumor 2 years later. Well, can be completely explained by nothing else happening other than it just showed up. It was visible. The level of the water was sufficiently low now so that we could see it. That the tumor, the volcano from under the level of water, decided to grow up enough to be visible above the level of the water. And I think this is something that is very difficult to mesh with I think this is this goes to much of the difficulty in interpreting clinical imaging of these patients, is that you've got all this stuff going on, and you don't know what to do with having random time intervals where you randomly observe these patients. What feels like randomly, it has to feel, from my perspective, from the physician's perspective, I would imagine it has to feel like it's a random thing, that patients are at different times in their different life cycle of their tumor, and you mesh that all together, and you couldn't possibly get a synthesis of what's going to have what feels like predictability to it. You would have to think that there's going to be unpredictable, that this is a new tumor, that this couldn't possibly be the thing that we lopped off and succeeded in treating for well over 2 years. So to bring that point one more time home, let's look at an example of a high-grade glioma that was actually followed with two imaging time points before treatment started. So I've got the whole benefit of the model so far. I can estimate D over rho, the contour. I can also estimate D times rho from, I have a velocity. I have this blue thick curved velocity. Now in this patient, we see it had a subtotal resection, and the model slide a few slides earlier says that subtotal resection is not going to have a significant effect, so let's just assume it didn't change the dynamic of the growth of the tumor. We only have a small number of cases in which we can have observations of this, but this is one of them. So what I've done is simply move down the volume to the subtotal resection point, and I attach this a straight line of the same slope as the blue curve here. Just in the background, I've got these green diamonds are plots of D and rho, D over rho over time, just so you can sort of see what's happening to that. So the question is that the patient, up to this point that the patient starts to receive chemotherapy or radiation therapy treatment, one would think that the tumor would progress along its, you know, untreated path. Then there would be some sort of treatment effect, and then perhaps the tumor, one of the questions that's often brought up in the Wednesday morning tumor board conferences is whether after the patient's been receiving chemotherapy and after the patient's received radiation therapy, has that fundamentally changed the biology of the tumor and fundamentally changed the dynamic of growth of the tumor? Maybe made it, sometimes they refer to the idea that the radiation therapy really irritated it and decided to make it grow faster, in the same sense that the surgery had this unexplained apparent regrowth that was much faster. And so in this case, the question is what would happen? And we would have, if the tumor had been untreated, we would have a model predicted behavior of this blue curve. But the tumor was treated, so we have these data points in the middle, and then treatment stops and the patient returns back to its normal. I actually have more data points out there for this particular patient, but I haven't included them on this picture. The point is that obscure your eyes a little bit and realize that if you didn't have these solid lines and these dotted lines in here, it would feel like random if you viewed this. It wouldn't feel like it was anything consistent. It would fail from here to here. It looks like you really irritated the thing. And then from here to here, between these two time points, it would feel like, well, it's pretty stable, that the radiation therapy is actually doing something useful, or the chemotherapy that we're using, which was in this case Temodar, is doing something useful. Between here and here, we're getting close to that maybe 25% increase in size, that maybe the patient is now failing treatment. There's lots of, when you micromanage each of these, it's very difficult. But if you have the advantage of some sort of theoretical background, you can have some prediction and understanding of what's happening in the dynamic. One of the most interesting things is the fact that it returned back to its baseline behavior right after treatment. But if you looked at this right after treatment, you would say that it didn't return to its baseline behavior. You'd compare this point and this point and say it grew a lot and it's really mad now, and so now we have to really come up with something to stop this thing. So this is another thing that goes to the complications of dealing with clinical data that are clearly very complicated, and each patient can be micromanaged until, you know, you go blind. But the point is that with a model like what I've only given you a snapshot of, is that given a pretreatment slope, given two imaging observations, the model can prove the effectiveness of any treatment in terms of net proliferations of growth, net proliferation and migration rates. So you can measure changes in rho and D. And one of the benefits of this is that patients can serve as their own control. So instead of comparing those groups of survival curves, you could compare individuals within that and have individual predictions about what's going to happen for each individual case. And the point, one other major point, is that the model is very simple and macroscopic at this level, but any number of molecular genetic mechanisms trickle their way down to one or both of these macroscopic mechanisms. And as we have more sophistication in treatment approaches, and as we look at more sophistication in the, we can add more sophistication to the model to incorporate these bits of information. These are just a sublist of some of the collaborators that have contributed to these projects here. And this is, of course, you have to acknowledge the support. So, thank you.